Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 16th of June, these are our main stories. A conference is underway in Switzerland to try to find a path to peace in Ukraine. An investigation is underway into the deaths of 8 Israeli soldiers in Rafah in Gaza. There's been an exchange of prisoners between Sweden and Iran. Also in this podcast... At Trooping the Colour, the Princess of Wales makes her first official appearance since being diagnosed with cancer. And the teenage maths genius in China, who is self-taught. In the Swiss resort of Bürgenstock, representatives from 90 countries are trying to find a path towards peace in Ukraine, 28 months after Russia's invasion of its neighbour. Russia hasn't been invited to the peace summit, and China, a key strategic partner for Vladimir Putin, is also not there. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, says failure to act will embolden other aggressors.
Freezing the conflict today with foreign troops occupying Ukrainian land is not an answer. In fact, it is a recipe for future wars of aggression. Instead, we need to support a comprehensive, just and sustainable peace for Ukraine. One that restores Ukraine's sovereignty and its territorial integrity.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky gave an impassioned plea for peace.
Putin has taken the lives of thousands of our people. Why? Because he wants to take over a neighboring country. I do not wish this to anyone. I sincerely wish that all of you, all the peoples of the world, every child, every family could simply live without war. And I want this for all Ukrainians. Ukraine had the right to peace, just like all of you.
But what can the two-day peace summit actually achieve after Russia's President Putin demanded Ukraine hand over all four regions that Russia claims to have annexed? Our Eastern European correspondent Sarah Rainsford is at the summit.
I'm talking to you now from a point in the mountains above Lake Lucerne, and I can't think of a place any further removed from what I've seen in Ukraine over the past 28 months. But this is the beautiful, tranquil, secluded spot where world leaders and delegations from all over the world are coming together to try to begin a tentative but critical process towards peace in Ukraine. But it's an extremely complex process, as we've already seen today. The whole point of this summit is to bring together countries, not just Ukraine's close allies in the West, but also other countries from what's often described as the global South, who are not necessarily 100% behind Ukraine's plan for peace in this route out of this war. So a whole diverse group of countries brought together to try to hammer out something which might begin to move Ukraine towards peace. Of course, that is so critically important for a country where tens of thousands of people have been killed so far in this war. But as you mentioned, Russia's not here. China, Russia's closest ally, has also stayed away from this process. And therefore, you know, it is difficult to see really how much actually can be achieved today. But I think the hopes for this process are high because the stakes are so extremely high.
Sarah, yesterday President Putin urged Ukraine to hand over four regions which Russia claims to have annexed. What does that tell us, do you think, about Russia's attitude?
Well, yeah, not just the areas that Russia controls physically on the ground, but Putin demanding that Ukraine also cede territory that Russia has claimed as its own in the constitution, so the four regions that it's claimed as its own, but that the Ukrainian government, Kyiv, controls. So a sort of maximalist position by Vladimir Putin, I think trying to disrupt what's happening today. I suppose the optimistic reading for Ukraine would be that it's because he's worried about what this summit shows, and he he wants to disrupt it. The other version is that he is simply seeing himself and seeing Russian troops as having the advantage on the ground, and he sees no reason now to move towards any kind of compromise. Certainly Ukraine has said, you know, it has no intention of compromising on the key things. But interestingly, I have spoken to Ukrainian officials here who have told me that if they can hammer out some kind of basic deal here, then ultimately Russia could be invited to this process, to a second summit.
Sarah Rainsford in Switzerland. The Russian journalist Elena Kostyuchenko decided to write a book about her country's path to war in Ukraine after covering the invasion for the independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta. That book, I Love Russia, has just won this year's Pushkin House Prize, which is awarded to the best non-fiction writing on Russia in the English language. The author spoke to Rebecca Kesby about her experience in Ukraine as a Russian journalist and how she felt witnessing war crimes perpetuated by soldiers from her country.
I was doing my best as a reporter, but it felt like I'm in some kind of nightmare, and I was eager to wake up. Of course, I feel a lot of responsibility for my countrymen, for people I grew up with. I was worried that Ukrainians won't speak with me because I'm Russian.
Mm.
But actually, they did speak with me because I'm Russian, because they saw me as a chance to pass information to other Russian people so they would know what's really happening in Ukraine, what's being done by Russian soldiers.
You went to Mariupol as part of your reporting, and tell us what happened to you there, because you got very serious death threats there, didn't you?
Mariupol was still resisting. It wasn't occupied yet, but it was kind of surrounded by Russian troops. And the only occasionally passable road was through Zaporizhia. Day before our planned trip, my colleague from Novaya Gazeta approached me. She called me and she asked me if I'm going to Mariupol. And I was quite surprised that she knows about that, because only very few people knew. Her sources contacted her and they told her that they knew that I was planning to come to Mariupol, and they had information on me, and they also have an order not to arrest me, not to detain me, but to kill me. I spent one more day in Ukraine because I really wanted to go to Mariupol despite of threats. Journalism was a salvation for me those time. I felt like I did what is needed. I just really, really wanted those information as wide known as possible, because it was troops of my country.
I just want to mention your book, though. The title is I Love Russia. And I wonder why you called it that and what you want people to understand about your Russia and your love for your country.
I wanted people to know that Russia is bigger than Putin. And when I say about loving Russia, it's more the feeling of belonging. And those feeling of belonging actually gives me strength to keep going.
Do you see a point where these two countries, Russia and Ukraine, can be the friends they once were again?
I believe Ukrainians should decide that, if they will ever be able to, I cannot even say world forgive, because what had happened is unforgivable. There are still relationships over the borders. And those ties, those connections, they give me hope. But first, war has to end.
That was Yelena Kostyuchenko. Now to Israel, where the military there say 8 of its troops have been killed in an explosion in Rafah in the south of Gaza. In a statement, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he was determined to pursue the conflict.
Despite the heavy and staggering cost, we must stick to the goals of the war, destroying the military and governmental capabilities of Hamas, returning all our hostages, making sure that Gaza will no longer pose a threat to Israel, and returning our residents safely to their homes, both in the north and in the south.
I asked our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bachega, who's in Jerusalem, what details have emerged about what happened to the soldiers.
This is one of the deadliest incidents for the Israeli military in this war. The army is saying that this armored vehicle that the soldiers were traveling in was hit by a large explosion. And then it appears that this initial blast then detonated explosive material in the vehicle. And it was a significant explosion, was difficult to identify and locate the bodies. And we still don't know what triggered the first explosion. A spokesman for the military said it was most likely caused by an explosive device in the area or by an anti-tank missile. And we know that earlier in the day, the armed wing of Hamas claimed to have carried out an attack with an anti-tank missile after setting up an ambush. So the deadliest attack for the Israeli military since January. Again, a very difficult day for the Israeli army in Gaza.
So, Hugo, what do you think this tells us about the remaining strength of Hamas after months of this conflict?
Well, it shows that despite all the destruction in Gaza, despite what the Israeli military has done in terms of trying to destroy the group's infrastructure capabilities, they still have the ability to carry out attacks that have a huge impact on the Israeli military. Reacting to what happened in Gaza, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he said the country must cling to the goals of destroying Hamas's military and governing capabilities. But I think again, lots of questions will be asked about the strategy in Gaza and about the goals of the Israeli authorities in Gaza.
And why are they concentrating so much on Rafah?
So this is where the Israeli authorities say that Hamas's last Romanian battalions are based. And for weeks now, this has been the key focus of the Israeli military. And obviously, this is where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been sheltering. This has been a very slow operation by the Israeli military. If you compare what's happening in Rafah with what happened earlier in the war in other parts of Gaza, and obviously the Israeli authorities don't want to cross that red line that was imposed by President Biden, who was against the idea of a major military operation. But it shows how difficult this has been. And obviously, they say that this offensive should continue because the goal here is to destroy the infrastructure being used by Hamas.
Hugo Bachega in Jerusalem. They have survived hell on earth. Those were the words of the Swedish Prime Minister as he welcomed home two Swedish citizens who'd been jailed in Iran on charges widely dismissed by the international community. Now the two countries have conducted a rare prisoner swap. In return for the two Swedes, Sweden has released an Iranian man convicted of murder and war crimes. The newsroom's Stephanie Zachrisson told me how this controversial exchange came about.
As is quite common in these types of exchanges, we aren't really told the whole story, the details which are mired in secrecy, mainly for security reasons. The government in Oman say they have been mediators between Iran and Sweden, which have quite strained relations, especially because of these cases of imprisoned Swedish citizens. Sweden's prime minister earlier said that it had been a dilemma for the government on how to handle this. But he said that they basically had to negotiate with Iran because if they didn't, two Swedish citizens would very likely have faced death in Iran.
So tell us about those involved in this swap.
Well, starting with the Swedes, the one we know most about is 33-year-old Johan Floderos. And that is because his family, after a few months of what's usually referred to as silent diplomacy, didn't see any progress in getting him released. They then decided to go public with his case. He works for the European Union's foreign services and was detained in Iran while he was there on vacation in 2022. He's been jailed there in the infamous Evin prison. He's been accused of espionage, which carries the death penalty in Iran, an accusation that's been called atrocious and baseless by the Swedish government. And the other Swedish citizen, Said Azizi, he had been arrested in Iran in November last year, and the accusations against him were similarly rejected. Let's listen to what Sweden's Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said earlier.
Iran imprisoned them both to use them as pawns in a cynical negotiations game to get the Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri released from Sweden. He was arrested in 2019 and has been sentenced to life in prison.
And Hamid Nouri, he is quite a known figure, isn't he?
Indeed, Val. He is part of the top level of the Iranian regime, a former judicial official there. He was arrested in Sweden in 2019 under international law as he basically landed at an airport in Sweden. And over this very long trial, which was very closely watched by Iran, he was in Sweden sentenced to life imprisonment for murders and war crimes, crimes against international law. This was because of his involvement in the mass killings of thousands of political prisoners in the late 1980s in Iran on the order of Iran's then supreme leader Ayatollah Khomeini. And these executions, they've never even been formally acknowledged by the Iranian establishment. Now Hamid Nouri has landed back in Tehran and he was there welcomed by Iranian top officials. But this decision to release him has been slammed as shameful by an exiled Iranian opposition group. The Swedish citizens, their release has been widely welcomed. Johan Fodir's father said he understandably was feeling very relieved.
Stephanie Zachrisson. The president of Honduras, Xiomara Castro, has announced a raft of measures to combat what she described as a security emergency. Ms. Castro also said a new prison will be constructed to hold thousands of people as part of the measures intended to suppress armed gangs. This report from Ed Horton.
Many of us have seen footage of hundreds of inmates dressed only in shorts, with heads bowed, sitting on the floor in tight rows as police search for contraband and weapons in a sweep of prisons. Honduras is adopting El Salvador's harsh prison tactics. The latest measures announced by the government include the building of a mega prison to hold around 20,000 people. The government also wants to reform the penal code so that members of criminal gangs who commit specific crimes can be designated as terrorists and face collective trials. Honduras has suffered years of gang violence that has made it one of the most violent countries in the world. Figures say on average 13 people are murdered every day. In June last year, 46 women were killed during a gruesome settling of scores between gangs at a prison northeast of the capital. That massacre sparked outrage across Honduras. It also prompted President Castro, who described the violence as the monstrous murder of women, to order sweeping changes to the penal system. Along with neighbours El Salvador and Guatemala, Honduras forms what has been called Central America's Triangle of Death, plagued by the gangs that control drug trafficking and organised crime. In 2022, Honduras declared a state of emergency, suspending parts of the constitution as it sought to bear down on crime. It hoped to copy the success of the approach by El Salvador, where the government's harsh policies have led to the murder rate dropping dramatically, but at a price. Human rights groups complain that police can now carry out arrests and searches without warrants, with thousands of innocent people caught up in police sweeps.
Ed Horton. Coming up on the Global News podcast.
These artworks, while they may be pretty, they have a very complicated and horrific history, and that history needs to be told.
The Swiss Museum, which has removed paintings from display over Nazi looting fears. Here in Britain, the Princess of Wales has made her first official appearance since being diagnosed with cancer and undergoing treatment. Catherine took part, together with her family, at the annual Trooping the Colour, the celebration of King Charles' birthday.
By the left! Quick, quick, horse!
Our correspondent Charlotte Gallagher was watching the event and told me how the princess looked.
She looked incredibly well, Val. I mean, let's be honest, the Princess of Wales always looks very well turned out. She's beautiful. She always wears incredible outfits. But she looked very, very well. She was wearing a close-fitted white dress with a navy trim, sort of like almost like a nautical theme, which matched quite well with what her daughter, Princess Charlotte, was wearing. I'm sure that was planned. And also a wide-brimmed hat. She looked elegant as always. She looked like she was having fun as well. She was smiling and laughing with her children in the carriage on the way to the event. She was waving at the public. And also the big moment that people really remember for these events is when they step out onto the balcony at Buckingham Palace, that very famous balcony at the front. And she was waving to the crowd, laughing with King Charles. So I think it was an incredibly positive first step from her back into public life. She's taken this time away for her treatment. She's still undergoing treatment. This isn't her getting back into the full duties, the full schedule of public life, because she said she's making good progress, but she's not out of the woods yet. And she said yesterday that people who've undergone chemotherapy will understand that you have these good days where you want to get out and make the most of feeling well, but you also have those bad days where you need to rest and you need to recuperate at home and listen to your body.
So does that mean we won't know when she's going to appear again, except perhaps a couple of days hence, or actually on the day?
I think that's right, Val. I think they're not going to be issuing calendars of events that she will be attending. I think it will be decisions made pretty much on a day-to-day basis. And that's how it was for the King when he started to make his re-entry into public life. He also, of course, has been treated for cancer and he has been attending events. He went to D-Day, Trooping the Colour. He was at Chelsea Flower Show, a society event in London, but he hasn't been doing those full calendar of events. So I think it's a very gradual process, obviously, for Catherine and her family and the people that look after the royal family. The priority is her health and recuperating from this.
Charlotte Gallagher. In just over a month, athletes from around the world will converge on the French capital for the Paris Olympics. But because of the invasion of Ukraine, Russia has been banned by the International Olympic Committee from sending a national team, as has its ally, Belarus. Some individual sportsmen and women will be allowed to take part, but not under the state flag. The first 25 athletes from Russia and Belarus have been cleared to compete, with others failing the vetting process because of their stance on the war in Ukraine. John Goodbody, Olympics reporter for the Sunday Times, describes how the system works.
The first thing to be absolutely clear is there is no Russian team going. In other words, in sports such as football or basketball, there will be no Russian team, nor will they be in a relay, any Russian team. Some Russians will compete in some sports, and that depends on a variety of criteria. One of them is whether the international governing body, who are responsible for all the individual sports, are going to allow competitors from Russia to take part. And World Athletics, under the presidency of Sebastian Coe, are banning any Russian or Belarusian from taking part in the game. But there are some individual sports where there will be Russian competitors, although they will not be able to say they are Russian competitors. They are neutral athletes.
John Goodbody. With the US election just months away, there's concern that some politicians could use anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric as part of their campaign. Many of those groups are concerned that could increase attacks on members of their community. As a result, some people have decided to attend self-defence classes in order to protect themselves. Sophie Williams reports from one class in Washington.
It's only June here in the US, but according to the American Civil Liberties Union, there are already more than 500 anti-LGBT bills working their way through state legislatures. They target issues like gender-affirming care and public school curriculums, including controlling discussions around sexuality. With the number of these bills rising, there are growing concerns about the safety of LGBT people, especially after a number of attacks on transgender people.
We know that hate crimes against LGBTQ people remain incredibly high. They are nearly the same rates as hate crimes committed against people because of their race or their religion.
That's Naomi Goldberg from the Movement Advancement Project.
Particularly for transgender women of color, Black and Latina, as well as Native American transgender women, there has been really incredibly high rates of violence, in particular in some cities. And often those cases go unsolved. And between now and November is a really precarious time. We know that the far right uses anti-LGBTQ rhetoric to stoke its base.
Stop! I said stop!
I've come here to a self-defense class for members of the LGBT community in Washington, D.C. M is teaching the class today.
A lot of people are really concerned, not only because of the political rhetoric, but also just like growing far right and white nationalist and fascist groups. And I think a lot of people do feel nervous and feel afraid about the kind of like violence that people are threatening. I am hearing more and more from people that they just really want to bone up on their skills around self-defense and taking care of themselves.
See those nice bent knees? I love that. Let's not like shatter our own kneecaps.
As the class goes on, we learn how to establish boundaries, warn people to keep their distance, and be firm.
Yeah, when you go to the back, you got to look, obviously.
And then we're taught moves that help push attackers away and disarm them so that we can make our escape. At the end of the class, I sit down with some of the attendees.
I definitely think that being in a circle and like being in a space where I'm like actively engaging with people, especially with other queer people, it felt good. You're here to be yourself and to learn something new.
Oakley said they decided to join the class due to a higher risk to the community.
We live in a world right now where the likelihood of confrontation is unfortunately increasing, so I wanted to have like the skills to be able to get myself to safety.
As M says goodbye to the class and sends them on their journey home, what does she think about having to teach these classes?
People shouldn't be attacking people. Trans women should be safe. We should all be safe. And we live in the real world. We don't live in utopia yet. So let's learn some skills to take care of ourselves.
Sophie Williams in Washington. One of Switzerland's leading art museums is removing five paintings from display while it investigates whether they were looted by the Nazis. The Kunsthaus Zurich say the future of the paintings is being discussed with the descendants of former owners. With more details from Geneva, here's our correspondent, Imogen Folks.
The Bourla collection has been mired in controversy for years. Emil Bourla was a Swiss arms manufacturer who sold weapons to Nazi Germany. He ended the Second World War Switzerland's richest man. He also collected art, in particular now priceless paintings by the French Impressionists. It's long been suspected that some works were looted by the Nazis or sold at knockdown prices by Jewish families desperate to escape Germany. Now Zurich's Kunsthaus Museum says five paintings will be removed from its collection while it works to establish their origins and to find a fair solution for the legal successors of their former owners. Switzerland has been slow to address the fact that, while it didn't fire a shot in the Second World War, many of its banks and businesses did profit from it. But new guidelines relating to looted art have been introduced, as well as a new government department devoted to tracing it.
Christopher Marinello is the founder of Art Recovery International, a private company that specialises in dispute resolution for the international art market. He told the BBC the museum needs to acknowledge the history of the paintings.
These artworks, while they may be pretty, they have a very complicated and horrific history, and that history needs to be told. They have to be seen in the context of how they got to this museum. The people who were murdered, the collections that were built by these either Jewish dealers or Jewish collectors, and how these paintings were forcibly removed from them. I mean, in one case of a Renoir that's in this collection, the young girl who is pictured in the painting, her entire family was murdered by the Nazis. That story needs to be told.
Christopher Marinello from Art Recovery International. Getting to the finals of an elite maths contest in China is hard enough in itself. But what if your grades weren't good enough to go to a top school, and as a result, you've had to study the subject in your own time? Well, that's the story for one 17-year-old girl in China. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton explains.
Jiang Ping has really stunned China. She's the talk of Chinese social media right now. And that's because she ranked very, very high in an elite math competition. Jiangping is 17 years old. She attends a vocational secondary school. So that's a school that's basically meant to prepare you for one of China's more lower paying jobs. It's not an academic school. She's studying fashion at the school. And she became interested in math a couple of years ago and started self-studying. A teacher of hers at the vocational school realized that she was pretty good at math, and he had studied math himself. He gave her some advanced textbooks, and she basically whizzed through them and now spends all of her spare time studying mathematics. She entered into the Alibaba Global Mathematics Competition. It's a special competition because anybody can enter it. You don't need to have any prior degrees. She entered and she ranked 12th out of the 800 people who actually made it into the final. She's the only woman in the top 30. She's the only secondary school student to have ever made the final. And she beat out a number of teams who had submitted artificial intelligence entries. So she basically beat the computers as well.
It's extraordinary. So what will happen next? Will she move schools?
Well, she's now fielding quite a few offers from top universities in China to study mathematics. But it really would be a major change of lifestyle for her. You know, she's grown up in quite a poor, quite rural part of China. She was attending a school that very few people had ever heard of before now. And she was really preparing for a life on a factory floor in a garment or textile factory in China.
And Celia, what do you think this tells us about the education system in China? I mean, it's very competitive, isn't it? And pretty unforgiving.
Exactly. Unforgiving is the perfect word, because back when she was 15, Jiangping wrote something called the High School Entrance Examination. And she did well in mathematics, but not very well in almost any other subject. And that's why she was not allowed to go on and study in a more academic school. Officials in Jiangsu, the province where Jiangping lives, have been fielding questions about why she wasn't given more of an opportunity. And so I think the realization is that there are probably many more people like Jiangping in China, many more people who are a little bit older than 15 who didn't do so well in that crucial high school entrance exam. And people are asking questions about whether that exam is unfairly cutting people off and really making too many choices for them at too young an age.
Celia Hatton. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by James Piper. The producer was Isabella Jewell. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.